Subway has teamed up with Live Nation to bring you great food and great music for a great value. Right now, buy a Subway $5 footlong and get a Live Nation concert ticket for $5 to participating Live Nation shows like Nickelback, The Fray, and Crew Fest 2. Ticket price does not include fees. See store for details. Subway. Eat fresh.
Eat fresh.
The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report, taping this on the Friday before Labor Day. I think it's going to go up over the weekend. Our old friend from ESPN.com, Mr. Chad Ford, is on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. What's happening?
Not much, man. I'm chilling in Hawaii, Bill.
Always a nice thing. Give me your take on this Ricky Rubio thing, because people in Minnesota are saying that I'm being a jerk and this is still a great thing for them and all that. What is your take? Where do you stand?
I think you just wish you were the GM.
And, well,
so you're going to be critical of David Kahn until they give it to you. I'm actually with you. I read a column in one of the Minnesota papers, I think it was yesterday, was talking about all these shadowy influences around Ricky Rubio, this family lawyer and this immaturity and, you know, all of these things. And I'm like, the Minnesota Timberwolves could not have played this thing more poorly. They gave the kid every incentive to sign in Europe, and then everybody's shocked when he didn't, and they're trying to blame Rubio. To me, it makes perfect sense. If you think about it from Rubio's perspective, he had to pay the $4 to $5 million buyout out of his own pocket. Regardless of what it was negotiated, he was going to be on the hook personally for that amount. Second, Kahn created a point guard controversy in the draft between him and Johnny Flynn. And he moves from a starting kind of European icon to coming into the NBA, having to fight for the position with Johnny Flynn. And the truth is, well, I think Rubio is going to be a much better point guard than Johnny Flynn. Right now, from day one, Johnny Flynn physically is more prepared to play in the NBA, and he's more used to the up-and-down style of the NBA than Rubio. And I think it would have been a challenge in year one competing with Johnny Flynn. And so he has to look at that and what his status might be. And third, I think that Ricky Rubio was never in love with playing in Minnesota. And if he could stay in Barcelona for the next 2 or 3 years, make good money, have somebody else pay his buyout, and then actually, given the collective bargaining rules, if he waits 3 years, he can go back and negotiate a max deal if he wanted to out of it. He had every incentive in the world to tell David Kahn, "Hey, I'm not coming to Minnesota." And I think all of that was because from day one, Minnesota misplayed their hand with Rubio, from drafting Flynn to making public statements about whether we don't really necessarily need him to come over for the next couple of years, to kind of the way the whole buyout situation was handled. I'm not saying Ricky Rubio is not to blame for some of this, but I don't think you could have mishandled this situation more poorly than the way Minnesota handled it.
Thank you, Chad Ford, because I agree with every single thing you just said. And, you know, here's the thing. They didn't make a mistake taking Rubio. It was the right pick. If you stop the draft right there, no matter what they do with number six, other than taking Johnny Flynn, I think he goes. I think he was ready to come to the NBA. I think he was ready to pay. He knew it was going to cost money out of his own pocket to do it. He didn't totally care where he went, although I think he would have preferred to be in a big market for the endorsements. But whatever, he wanted to come over here and play. The next pick, they take a point guard who's 2 years older than him, who's going to beat him out for the starting job, put him on the bench. He's on a bad team in a bad organization in a small market. What was to gain for him to come to Minnesota?
There was no incentive, and Minnesota didn't create one for him. And so it seems so simple to us kind of in retrospect, because after they picked Ricky Rubio, who's a pass first point guard, who's a special playmaker, you draft Stephen Curry.
Yes. I agree.
Who Rubio penetrates, he dishes, Stephen Curry's wide open. You got two wildly popular players in the backcourt, guys who complement each other so well together. And you start to build this, and you also have Kevin Love and Al Jefferson, who's a pretty good player. You start to build this whole momentum around this team of interesting and different types of personalities. You go Johnny Flynn, and all of that just crumbles apart. And
it's
a disaster.
I think they underestimated how smart Rubio is about basketball and his own career and all that stuff. Because first of all, when Khan says, "Oh, we think these guys can play together," that's idiotic. Number one, because you don't play 2 point guards together, especially 2 point guards, 1'6", 4", 1'6", who are both used to having the ball all the time. That's not going to work. Second, Rubio is smart enough to say, wait a second, I don't think 2 point guards can play together. And also, if it turns out that they can't, who's going to get the playing time? Me or the guy who's been in college, who's ready to be in the NBA right now and be good? Obviously, that guy's going to get the playing time. So now I'm on the bench. I'm backing this guy up. Everybody's saying I'm a bust. Why do I want to do that? I could just stay here in Spain and just get better at my own pace. And then, as you mentioned before, the part that nobody talked about until, and I didn't even know about it until Chris Sheridan wrote about this week, if he stays in Spain for 3 years, he can come in. The rookie scale does not apply to him. So there is no financial incentive whatsoever for him to come into the league in 2011. On top of that, there's going to be a lockout. So if Minnesota thinks they're going to see Ricky Rubio in 2 years, they're crazy. There's not a chance he's playing for Minnesota.
And, you know, here's the other interesting thing is the fact that, and this often is the case, is that his agent, Dan Fagan, who has quite a reputation in the league, gets kind of cast as the villain. I heard Peter May call him the much despised or universally, hated Dan Fagan. Well, there's a reason why GMs don't like Dan Fagan. It's because he's brilliant. He is a brilliant negotiator. He always gets what he wants for his client. I promise you it wasn't Ricky Rubio and his family that figured out that rookie salary scale thing. Or it wasn't a family lawyer who was talking about all the potential complications for Ricky Rubio's career by playing in Minnesota with Johnny Flynn. Dan Fagan, from the moment that Johnny Flynn was drafted, Dan Fagan's goal was to either get this guy traded to another NBA team. That was his first goal. Or if not, to get him a sweetheart deal in Europe that allowed him to continue to progress, that got somebody else to pay for his buyout, and then he would be ready to go. And, you know, I think Fagan did what was in the best interest of his client, and that's why sometimes I think GMs get frustrated with him. He's not working with the GMs, or he's working on behalf of his client. But in this case, if I was Dan Fagan, I would have given Ricky Rubio the exact same advice that he got.
Well, people
told him not to sign that deal.
People keep asking me, why are you so mad about this? Like, and people from Minnesota, I love the people in Minnesota. I have a lot of readers there. I think they're good people. I feel bad for them that their sports experience with the football and basketball teams hasn't been better. I think they're a little beaten down, which is kind of the reason they're accepting this. But here's the thing. You make these trades that you made. You basically blow up a team that before Al Jefferson got hurt, people were starting to feel pretty good about. You know, Corey Brewer's coming back this year. They had a lottery pick. They had Kevin Love. They had Jefferson's going to be back by November, December. They had Randy Foy, who was playing really well before he got hurt. It's not like this was the 2009 Knicks, where it was like, this is a disaster. We got to do something different. So they blew that up to trade for this number 5 pick. Now, here's my conspiracy theory. I don't think they ever thought Ricky Rubio was going to be there at 5. I don't think they planned for it. I think they thought they were going to get Tariq Evans or James Harden. They're going to take Johnny Flynn 6. I think they made a promise to Johnny Flynn, and they were going to go forward with this new team. What they didn't realize was Rubio was going to drop, and I just think they panicked.
Well, I think your conspiracy theory is more than right. I was covering the draft very closely. They were trying to move up into the draft. They're trying to package one of their late picks. Move up, and Ricky Rubio was their guy that they were after. And I think they realized at the end of the day they weren't going to get that done, had settled on Flynn, and, you know, then everything fell apart. You know, right after the draft, I called someone that I'm close with in the Minnesota front office and asked them, not David Kahn, and asked them what the heck was going on, and they were laughing because they were saying, we're wondering the same thing. And so, you know, here's a case where I don't want to be too hard on David Kahn. This is a tough, being a GM is a tough job. You've got 1,000 people second guessing every move that you make, and he was pretty new into the job when he had to tackle the draft, but he knows all the criticism about him not being a basketball guy. He knows that there's all sorts of past things, you know, people don't like him, whatever. There was a lot of criticism about him being hired as the GM over other guys. So he needs to look like the smartest guy in the room. He has to do something different, kind of mavericky, that really shows that he's a genius. I just think he overthought the entire thing.
Yeah.
I think he's not that he's dumb. It's that sometimes you can be too smart for your own good.
Well, and here's another thing that people need to realize, because this is actually, in terms of preserving your job, it's kind of a smart move to say, we're blowing it up. Now we have this little carrot. I'm going to dangle this Ricky Rubio carrot in front of you guys for the next 2 to 3 years. We have an asset. We have, right. So here's a guy in the future that we have hope for. Now that's basically going to excuse the fact that this team's going to stink the next 2 years. It takes him right. off the hook of actually having to make it better. Now, if you really wanted to make things better short-term, long-term, you take Rubio 5, then you either take Stephen Curry 6, or you trade, you know, swap picks with the Knicks. Get Wilson Chandler, the 8, dump a contract, get a future number 1 lottery protector or whatever, and give them 6 so they can have Johnny Flynn and their fans can be excited. But don't do what you did.
It's a mess, and I've just really enjoyed it. I mean, David Kahn is smart, and how do I know he's smart? Because I read the Minnesota papers, and I read their anonymous sources, and how this is getting spun in Minnesota is amazing to me. It's almost like they found weapons of mass destruction.
Well, how about the part where he says Rubio backed out on Saturday, but then he kills himself, or that theory, by also saying that on Saturday, when Rubio had allegedly agreed, he said, I never felt good about it. I never felt like it was done. Well, then how did Rubio back out if you never felt good about it? What was it?
Yeah.
He's talking that at both ends, and now he's painted this kid as, oh, yeah, we had him, and my big plan worked, but then the kid backed out. He's a scumbag. Yeah. Like, that's the implication. So now Rubio's going to play for you? You just made up something about him.
And here I think in fairness to Kahn, I actually think that in a certain way, and maybe this is too strong a word, he was getting played a little bit too. I do think he was hearing, you know, listen, if we can work out this buyout with Minnesota, we'll come. I mean, I don't think David Kahn would have flown over there a number of times to try to work this out if he was getting a clear signal that there's no way Ricky Rubio is going to sign with you.
Yeah.
I think that the issue was Fagan was trying to work hard to try to find a trade. And if he couldn't find a trade, then he was already working on these deals in Europe. When it came to the point that Minnesota had actually worked the buyout out, and so there wasn't going to be a trade anymore. Minnesota's now saying, we're taking you, we're going to bring you over, we've worked out the deal. He was out of choices. Ruby at that point had to go ahead and agree to the deal with Barcelona, because they I don't really think they ever had a deep intention after the draft of signing with the Minnesota Timberwolves.
I agree.
And so,
well, let me ask you this.
Their bluff, and they called it back.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's say Fagan says to him, "We'll come, but you have to trade Johnny Flynn, and you can't make it seem to anybody like we told you to do this. But we're not going to come, and we're not going to have Ricky compete with Johnny Flynn." Could he have shopped Johnny Flynn around, and what could he have gotten for him?
Yeah, I think he could have. You know, I think that would have been, you know, a good move. And listen, I understand when GMs don't want to play their hand out and say they have to trade this guy, because you know what happens in the league. They get offers that are 10 cents on the dollar from every GM in the league who's looking for a bargain. And there was plenty of people, including the Knicks, who would have loved to have had Ricky Rubio, who tried to get in there and give something in return. And Kahn wanted more Rubio because I think in this case Kahn is right. Rubio is a good asset.
Well, wait a second, though.
Yeah,
I've heard different. I've heard that he wouldn't even discuss it. Like, teams would call, and he just was, no, we're not trading him, and wouldn't even, like, entertain offers.
Well, that may be the case. What I'm saying is that he was smart in one sense, whether he felt that way or not, to do that, because every GM, I mean, the same thing happened with Carlos Boozer in Utah. Carlos Boozer goes to the press, says, listen, we've worked out a deal with Utah. They're going to trade me. well, you know, what's Kevin O'Connor got to do at that point? He's got to basically tell everybody who calls for the first week, absolutely not, we're not moving the guy because everybody's offering Quentin Richardson for Carlos Boozer.
Right.
And he wants more than that.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to play that hard edge. So, again, I think this is not so much that David Collins stupid, because I don't think he is. I've met him. I think he's a highly intelligent guy. I think it's a combination of being too smart for your own good, overthinking things, and two, one thing that does cut against guys like David Kahn or Bill Simmons or Chad Ford who are not players is sometimes it's hard for us to totally get our arms around the mentality of a player and how they perceive the world differently than maybe how you or I perceive the world. I think you and I have been around it long enough that we feel like we have a feel for that. I got the sense from the minute they drafted Johnny Flynn that David Kahn had no sense at all of how that was going to play in Rubio's camp personally, psychologically, for him and his family, and that was the seeds of their destruction.
It's a great point, and I also think a level of stubbornness comes in as well, where if you make a trade or you do whatever, then you're kind of sort of admitting that maybe you didn't make the right move on draft night and he didn't want to do that. So it's much easier to just do the, he backed out. Not my fault. I did my best. I flew to Spain a few times.
Yeah.
It's
interesting. He has come out as kind of the hero. Boy, we exhausted every resource. We did everything. But hey, you know, the kid's a teenager. And,
yeah.
You know, teenagers are like this. Or, I mean, give me a break. This is, in psychological terms, this is called cognitive dissonance. And it's when you have an image of yourself, and you can't do anything that's contrary to that image, even if it's the right thing to do, because then you have this problem on your hand. I drafted this guy, but now I'm trading him, which gives the impression that I did the wrong thing. I can't give the impression I did the wrong thing because I must be seen as the smart GM who knows what I'm doing. So I'm just going to hold on for dear life and hope this thing works out.
I like that you dropped a psychological term on there. That was pretty cool.
And that's what happens in the league. It's what happens all the time when people hold on to assets too long.
Yeah.
You know, when they make a bad signing and then they have to go out of their way to kind of justify the reasons why they had to go to signings, it's everybody suffers from it. It's a natural psychological phenomenon, and it gets people in trouble all the time, and I think it got Minnesota in big-time trouble.
Yeah, and it's funny. The psychology of GMs affects the destiny of teams so much more than people realize, and I think we saw it in Toronto this summer with Brian Colangelo. This is a guy now who is in a make-or-break year for his franchise. Every move that he made was to make this team as good as possible, as immediately as possible, and to potentially convince Chris Bosh to stay and re-sign
right.
with the team. Now, just because those moves were good for this coming year doesn't mean that they were good for 2012, 2013. In fact, long-term, they all hurt the franchise, every move he made. Now, you could say, well, hey, we want to win now, blah, blah, blah. But really, he doesn't care whether the franchise wins. He cares whether he wins because he
yeah.
wants to keep his job.
Yeah, and, you know, coaches actually suffer from this even more than GMs. I mean, coaches make all sorts of ridiculous trade suggestions throughout the year and the off season because all they're thinking about is the next game. And they're trying to win that season. Usually GMs try to be a little more attached, but I agree with you in Toronto. I think they're a better team this year than they were last year. But I think the problem is they're not going to be good enough to compete with the three or four elite teams in the East. And at that point, Bosch has got to look and say, will we ever be good enough? In fact, actually, no. I actually think we'll be worse off in a couple of years. And so he actually has even more incentive now. I've actually thought Cleveland has misplayed their situation with LeBron the same way. Now, at the end of the day, I think LeBron will probably end up signing there because he really has no other good alternative next year. But their mentality all along is, well, if we win LeBron a championship, he'll stay. So we keep bringing in old guys and you know, filling the roster up that way. We trade for Ben Wallace and we do all these things. But LeBron doesn't have one guy on the Cavaliers, unless you're in love with Mo Williams, who he can grow old with.
No.
The way Michael Jordan was able to grow old with Scottie Pippen, or the way Sean Kemp and Gary Payton were able to grow old together. There's not one other young star on this team. They can play together the next 10 years.
You made this point on the podcast the last time I had you on about how if LeBron had 2007 Sam Presti in 2004, his whole career would be different.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Sam Presti has the it's interesting because they both come out of the Spurs organization. It had the opposite approach. He understands difficult to keep Kevin Durant in Oklahoma City. The best way to keep him there is to surround him with one guy, young guys that he likes. They can say, listen, we can grow old together, and in 3 or 4 years, we're all going to be awesome, and then we're going to have a long shelf life. Yep. The Cavs have a shelf life that you have to address every single season.
Yeah, and also, you know, I think Presti, and you know what? I got to say Chris Wallace and the Sacramento guys as well maybe deserve a little bit of credit for sniffing out this Rubio thing a little bit.
You mean and passing on him?
Yeah, because I thought Presti was crazy to pass on him, but now I understand maybe combo of James Harden, great character guy, swing man, can't lose with him, and then, you know what, maybe I don't want to mess with Ricky Rubio's weird buyout and not get him for 3 years.
Yeah, here was the deal. He didn't want to play in Memphis, and so I do think Chris Wallace sniffed that out early on and knew he had a major PR disaster on his hand.
Yeah.
You know, he actually wanted to play in Oklahoma City. I know that from talking to him and his representatives. That was their dream because they wanted Ricky paired up with a couple of other young, up-and-coming players. I mean, it was the same situation. I mean, who wouldn't love to pass to Kevin Durant and to, you know, at that point, Russell Westbrook, who I think could have probably played in the backcourt with Ricky Rubio. They're just such different players.
I agree.
And a great organization that you know has a plan. You know they're going to go forward. It's not the greatest market, but it's going to be a really good team and a great situation. No pressure on Rubio to win. And Sacramento was really, I think, a tear between people in the front office, between Jeff Petrie on one side and other people in the organization on the other side that were fighting between immediate impact, which a guy like Tyreke Evans should have. He should be one of the more productive rookies in his rookie year, and a long-term impact on the franchise, which Rubio has. And I think Petrie is a little worried that, given a few busts that he's had lately, that he needed an immediate impact guy that kind of justified him keeping the job right away. And I think that's why Evans over Rubio, though, you know, I think Tyreke Evans is going to be a good player. I mean, I wasn't totally distraught with that pick because I think Tyreke Evans will be good.
If you're saying impact player in terms of missed shots and turnovers, I think he's going to be your guy. I think he's going to have a couple struggling
years. He's going to be Jerry Stackhouse. I think that's who he's going to be.
Yeah, and Jerry Stackhouse took 6 years before he's somebody you wanted on your team.
I'm not sure you ever wanted him, but he's been in the league a long time. And anymore, I think GMs, especially in a bad draft, and that was a bad draft that we just suffered through. If you can get a guy who say, hey, he's going to be in the league 10 years, that's doing something, even in the lottery. Because I don't know that Hashim Thabeet's going to be in the league 10 years.
I think, well, yeah, both you and I were not big Thabeet fans, and I think Summer League kind of helped our cause a little bit on that front. But I think the biggest surprise for me this summer was this whole Shaq-Steve Nash thing, which feels like it should have been just a gigantic story and really wasn't. And now I find myself reevaluating Shaq's entire career, where in each city where he's left, there's been not just burned bridges, but like carnage, you know? And now it's like, well, maybe Kobe Bryant wasn't that bad of a guy. You know, maybe Shaq was more responsible for a lot of the stuff that happened than we realized. Look at how he left Miami. Look how
Penny
he left
Hardaway.
Phoenix. Yeah, look at Penny Hardaway in Orlando. And now you look at him in Cleveland, and this is a guy who clearly cannot let go of the fact that he still thinks he's the big ticket. He doesn't. The only time we've ever seen him say, I am happy being a supporting rebounder, shot blocker, and just fitting in was those 2 months in Phoenix after the trade.
Right.
I am not sold on him at all, taking a backseat to LeBron. What do you think?
I'm not sold at all. You know, I understand the people that argue, well, how can you argue against this trade because they ended up trading two guys who were essentially worthless to the team for somebody who should have some impact on the team, more impact than Ben Wallace had. And I get that, and Shaq's going to have an impact that way. It's the question of chemistry and all sorts of other negative impacts that I wonder how that's going to balance out. There's no question on the court he has a bigger impact than Ben Wallace and Pavlovich. And, you know, Shaq can still score in the post, and he can still rebound a little bit, and he can do some things. But two things. One, Phoenix did an incredible job of getting him in shape and keeping healthy. And they're renowned for their trainers and their ability to do that. I think he's going to miss that in Cleveland.
Nash even said that was one of the reasons he re-signed. He didn't want to roll the dice with another team from a health standpoint.
Grant Hill, same thing.
Yeah.
Another guy who struggled with injuries throughout his career. Same point. So let's see about how that affects Shaq. LeBron is used to this being his team. Everybody falls in line. Really, from day one, this has been LeBron's team and nobody else's team. Can Shaq take that back seat? I have questions too, and I think it'll be an issue. I don't think it'll be an issue on the surface, like it wasn't really a big issue on the surface in Phoenix, in part because Steve is a pretty discreet guy, and LeBron actually is pretty discreet about those things. Kobe, the reason we knew about it was he couldn't be discreet about any of those things. Kobe was constantly whining and complaining about it.
Wouldn't it be funny if we had imagined Kobe's, or at least like somebody like me who's been a huge Kobe detractor, that he was an awesome guy all along and Shaq caused this and the girl in Colorado was totally made everything up and he's just been on some bad teams and actually he's a fantastic guy?
That would be bad.
I think my whole world would collapse. What would I be able to hold on to in life?
If Darko Milicic turns into an all-star in New York this year, what would you have left, Bill? What would you have left?
Nothing. Well, I don't think I have to worry about Darko. And just like you don't have to worry about Adam Morrison. Although supposedly he looked good in Summer League, my man Adam. I'm not giving up on him.
So did Skeeta, by the way. Skeeta had a scoring record in the Las Vegas Summer League.
There you go. That's why
Summer League, Mikey Moore, I think, scored like 50 points in a Summer League game one time. So
my friend Daryl, the Rockets GM, was raving about Chase Budinger in Summer League. And I was like, I can't. I'm not even going to listen to it. Just stop. After watching Kedrick Brown in 2002 or 2003 look like 1992 Michael Jordan in Summer League, and I would have bet my house that he was going to become a superstar and was out of the league in like 2 years, I just can't take Summer League seriously anymore.
You can't. Well, here's what you can take seriously out of Summer League. If a guy sucks in Summer League, that's especially a guy who's been drafted high, that's a huge red flag.
Yeah, that is. You're right.
That there's a problem. If he's great in Summer League, it means nothing.
You know what else?
He may be good. He may not be good. But if he's bad, I'm struggling to think of an example of a guy who was terrible in Summer League who then turned around and had a great rookie season.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. The other thing I think you can learn is more of a chemistry thing. You know, I thought the fact that Durant showed up and supported the team that shall not be named and was really like a leader. And I saw one of the games and he's giving guys instructions during timeouts. And it wasn't like he was doing it to be like, watch this, I'm the big gun. But it was like it was genuine. You know, he just wanted to be there. It's his team. I think he gets that it's his team. And then you see, you know, what happened with the Olympic practices or the dream team. What do we call those? Qualifying practices? But, I mean, he played, you know, he basically lit it up. And now everybody's like, oh, yeah, this guy's going to be in the 2010 team. It's a foregone conclusion. Seems like he's made – we're seeing a leap. There's a leap happening. I can feel it. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, everybody loved Kevin Durant and everybody loved Greg Oden and you know, everybody knew both those guys were going to be great. But when everything was getting factored in on the Greg Oden versus Kevin Durant debate, I think the thing that didn't get enough play with Durant was this guy is hungry. He's got the eye of the tiger. He had it in Texas. He was known as a workout fiend, constantly in the gym, working on his jump shot or whatever. He's got that hunger on the basketball court to be better, to be great.
Yep.
And Greg Oden has never had that. Never had that.
It's
a huge thing.
Well, for me, I remember that was what swung it because Oden had kind of won me back a little with how good he was in the championship game. But then when I was reading the workouts and Oden just distracted and not good in the workouts, and then you read at the time how Durant handled his business at the different workouts. I was like, all right, that has now swung it because this guy obviously, as you said, eye of the tiger. He just wants it. And if you study the course of history, the guys that matter when you're talking about super-duper stars, you're talking about the Pantheon guys, with a couple exceptions like somebody like Shaq, the guys who made it the furthest were guys that just had that different – they just needed it. They needed to win. They needed to be in the gym. They needed to just compete and be better than everybody at all times. And he's got it. He's got that gene.
He has it. And you know where it just totally hit me that this guy is going to be one of the best of all time was actually at your event at the All-Star game, the horse event.
Yeah.
The way he took over the end of that game, which was for fun, and, you know, everybody was taking lighthearted, but you just saw like a switch flick in Kevin Durant's head when he thought, yeah, I can win this thing.
Yeah.
And then he was an assassin out there. It reminded me of that same special thing that Jordan had where you talk about, no matter what, you play tic-tac-toe with Jordan. You play chess with Jordan. Checkers, the minute he thinks he can beat you, he goes through the jugular.
Right.
In any game, it's not just basketball. You saw that with Durant, that same kind of intensity, and I was like, holy crap. He just went out and assassinated those guys, and he's going to be amazing.
Well,
and, you know, he was so good the second half of the season. He was the second best small forward in the entire league, I thought, only behind LeBron.
And I'm not, you know, this is why I thought he should be number one in 2007, because I wasn't sure of the ceiling that he would have. And now we're heading into his third season. And there's some things on the table that I never thought I'd see before. Like, we might see this guy. I don't want to jinx it. I don't want to go over hyperbole, but this might be a guy who averages 35, 36 points a game, shoots 50% from the field, 45% from three, and 90% from the line. Now, we have never seen that before, ever, in professional basketball. And this is now on the table for this guy.
I think it's on the table.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I'll be shocked, actually, if he doesn't average 30 points a game this season.
Me too.
I think he's going to. And for a guy in his third year in the league to average 30 points a game and do it efficiently is really, you know, an amazing thing. He's special. I just wish we could see more of him. You and I have league pass, but
yep.
I wish we could see more of him on national TV.
Oh, they botched it. They, you know, as usual, there's always one thing they botch with the TV schedule, and this year it was the team that should not be named, who should be on at least six times. And I'll tell you another thing, because I was in Vegas and I was looking at the NBA odds and stuff. And I'm not saying they could win the title this year, but if you're going to look at a team that people are going to be writing about maybe like late December, mid-December of the, wow, where did these guys come from? That might be the best bet. I'm not sure that this team can't just be good this season.
Yeah, a little bit like the way the Blazers were last season.
I think
people knew the Blazers were going to get better. If you'd have said, you know, listen, they're going to win 50-plus games and be in there at the very last day for the second seed in the West, people would have said, you know, you're crazy. But they put it all together. They have great chemistry. I expect great chemistry out of Oklahoma City.
Good coach.
Good coach. Not the same track record that Nate McMillan has, but a good coach. You know, they're going to have to figure out how to play defense.
Yeah.
And you know, do some things. I think they have problems. I don't think they'll be in the playoffs, but I think your point is good. You know, and by the way, I read your Vegas column. You're getting too old for that.
I know that was probably the last one. I think I'm retiring. I turned 40 in like 4 weeks, so it's that could have been the last one.
It kind of creeped me out a little bit. You know, a couple of years ago when they had the pre-draft camp in Orlando, I had like a day, and you know, what do you do in Orlando? I was like, oh, I'll just go to Disney World or something, ride some rides. And man, I got creeped out. Like parents were like, women were looking at me like, what is this guy doing here? Is
they think
like,
you're
Alba Lester or what?
Scoping the kids. Yeah. I'll tell
you. I just like, I can't go. I can never go back to Disneyland unless I have a small child in tow. It's just, you're too old. And boy, I was starting to feel that out of your Vegas column.
Yeah. Believe me, we were all feeling it while we were there, especially when we went to the nightclub. The other thing I like about the team that should not be named is, you know, the good people of Oklahoma City, who have been very fair in this whole thing, you know, it's not, they didn't ask to steal the team. It's not their fault that the two owners are scumbags. I think they've handled themselves, you know, they've adopted the team. They've really supported it. That reminds me a little of the 2009 Blazers as well. You got to have that good crowd if you're going to be the sleeper. And I also think you look at the Western Conference and, it seems like a lot of teams took a step back or went sideways or, you know, even you look at maybe the Lakers, we don't know if Artest is going to single-handedly sink that ship. Like, I don't know. Could happen.
I keep, you know, if you follow Ron Artest on Twitter.
He's a lunatic.
He's insane.
He's insane. He's a crazy person.
And I just wonder, like, how Mitch Kupchak, like, every day, I'm sure whether he follows him or he has somebody on his PR staff following him on Twitter, is just dying a little inside every day, and not re-signing Trevor Ariza. Seeing this guy in LA now with Twitter, where he doesn't need the filters, anymore to, really kind of rein him in.
Right.
That's going to be the most entertaining story, I think, of the season, and it'll just be how, not if or when.
Let's have a little draft of stories that we're really secretly or openly looking forward to this season. We just mentioned two: Durant and Artest. I would like to throw in the stories and the anecdotes that are being floated around right now about Don Nelson. I mean, there's always been the joke, like, he doesn't really care anymore. He's not coaching the team. Now it's like there's just concrete evidence now that he is literally packed it in, does not coach the team anymore, and is just, his job is to basically get dressed and be on time for the games.
It's going to be, I mean, I think ESPN labeled them team disaster this year.
Yes.
And I don't know how there's any way that it can't be team disaster.
Total disaster.
There's so many elements in play that point towards disaster in Golden State. Not to mention, you know, forget, Don Nelson's not the worst part of this organization. I think Robert Roel and Chris Cohen, who just have no clue what's going on.
Right.
I mean, from top to bottom, what a messed up organization. I have a friend who wants to buy the Warriors, and I know the NBA got a few pleas. Please sell this to anybody.
Right.
Anybody.
Well,
other than Michael Heisley.
Well, what's sad is, yeah, there's like five owners like that now, where I think the NBA would be doing backflips if anybody bought the team other than the people they already have in place.
So where is the screening process? I understand money is the issue, but with all the great things that David Stern does, next time you have him on your podcast, you need to really grill him. Where is the screening process for these guys? I mean, I understand he can take a mulligan on Donald Sterling.
Yeah.
It happened before his time.
Yep.
But for the rest of these guys, what is David Stern thinking?
I think ultimately he has no control. Like, you're going to sell a team, and unless you're selling it to Joe Francis of Girls Gone Wild, and it's just, there's, everybody can agree this is a horrible idea and awful for the league. You can't really, I guess, make character generalizations on whoever's buying. But, man, they have had some misfires. It's really bad. You know, and you look at, like, when did George Shin? I mean, they gave him that team as an expansion team.
Yeah.
Think about that. This was the guy they decided was their best bet to get basketball going in Charlotte. George Shin. Like, it's you're right. It's no accountability.
It boggles the mind, because the NBA, at the end of the day, is a partnership. And the way that the league is right now, with collective bargaining and everything else, what one team does to screw things up actually affects a lot of other teams as well. The brand of the league and everything else. You know, you still have GMs around the league seething that Pau Gasol was given away to the Lakers.
Oh, my God.
Because it affected the entire competitive balance of the league in a trade that made no sense to anyone. And by the way, how about the Grizzlies then replacing Pau Gasol with Zach Randolph, who actually makes more money?
I know. It's a little wrinkle that got lost. Yeah, they trade Gasol because he makes too much money, and then bring in Zach Randolph, who's making more money than Gasol.
And then act just absolutely flabbergasted that everybody isn't patting him on the back for getting a 20-10 low post scorer that everybody said they needed. Yeah, that guy was Pau Gasol. That was the guy they needed, not Zach Randolph. I mean, can you imagine? The Clippers have had an amazing summer. I mean, isn't that the other story, that there's finally hope in LA? I mean, not only Blake Griffin, but getting trading Zach Randolph. I mean, for Quentin Richardson.
I'm legitimately excited. I will go to 25 or 30 games this year. This is the first fun Clippers team they've had since I moved to Los Angeles. You know, I got tickets to see the other teams, but you want the Clippers to be at least confident enough to, you know, and they had the 1 year with Cassell where they won.
The Generals, yeah.
Right, yeah. They had the 1 year when Cassell won. That was a fun team, but this team could be really entertaining. And you know, they have a lot of different elements to it. The Rasul Butler trade was a really underrated trade. Like, that's kind of the 3-point shooter that they had been missing the last couple of years. And, I would throw them in. I also think, I don't know if they're an absurd, I wrote this in a mailbag. They're not an absurd LeBron destination except for the Sterling component.
I agree with you. In fact, I think it would be by far the most interesting move that LeBron could do. Is to say, okay, I'm going to leave Cleveland, I'm going to go to L.A., I'm going to partner with Baron Davis and Eric Gordon and Blake Griffin. You know, that is a team that, wow.
Monster team.
It's a monster team. Talk about him immediately having two guys, you know, in Gordon and Blake Griffin that he can grow old with.
Yeah.
You still have veterans on the team, so it's not, you know, it's not really a rebuilding situation. It's a monster team, and I can't come up with a good reason other than Donald Sterling for LeBron not to do that. It's a better situation than New York. It's a better situation than the Nets. You know, the only other place that, you know, he could go, which I would totally understand, is if he wants to go to Miami and just play with Dwayne Wade. But I think the underreported story about Dwayne Wade is, you know, Dwayne Wade is actually quite a bit older than those other guys.
Yes.
And the way he plays, I just don't know. How much he has left. When he is healthy, he's as good as anybody in the league. But I think he could be Tracy McGrady older in his career and just really struggle to stay healthy enough to really make a difference. So I wouldn't put all my chips in that basket if I was LeBron or Chris Bosh for that matter.
Yeah, and also you start talking about surgically repaired shoulders. That's one of those parts of your body that's, you know, you get it surgically repaired, but it's still lingering. It's not like getting a torn meniscus fixed or something.
Right.
It could always come back. I would throw one other – well, I'd throw two other LeBron destinations. Neither of that makes sense for him from a marketing standpoint. But if he just wanted to win titles, I think he goes to the Clippers or the team that shall not be named. Because if you're just talking about a situation where you're going to grow old as the main guy surrounded by young legs that are only going to get better in an awesome situation, those are two good places for him. And I think the other – kind of makes sense. Not the same great talent situation, but Nike's there. Portland doesn't seem far-fetched to me.
No, they're not going to have the money, but they could work it out. They've got enough assets. They could figure it out.
They're not going to have cap space next year?
They're not LeBron cap space.
Yeah, but they could still, you know, give people money and take this contract. You're right, though. Like, team that shall not be named would have a much easier time just fitting him.
They could just sign him. You know, Chicago's the other team that could be far enough under the cap if they did some things. If they let Tyrus Thomas go, you know, they could do it.
That's kind of intriguing. No?
It is. Derrick Rose and LeBron James is probably more than kind of intriguing. I mean, that's an amazing combination. I like Oklahoma City. I think it would be great. But the Clippers, of all things, I mean, and just because Kobe's still got a few years left on him, just to finally have that Clippers-Lakers rivalry be the high-end rivalry that I think people have always wanted it to be would be fantastic. And it'd be great, you know, from a marketing standpoint, amazing for LeBron to be in LA.
Yeah, I hope we have 30 for 30 coming up on ESPN, the documentary series. The first one's about Wayne Gretzky. And it's about the trade that landed him from Edmonton to Los Angeles and all the factors that went into it. It's really fascinating. But he's kind of wistful after the fact about it, because the bottom line is, in the prime of his career, he went from this team that had won 4 Stanley Cups, that was just overloaded with talent, to try to carry this Kings team. He only ended up playing in one more Stanley Cup. They didn't win. And that was it for his career. And you could kind of tell as you're watching this, like, he's thinking, man, I kind of wish I had just kind of stayed with the best team of guys that I could have. And I really wonder, like, if LeBron, if he guilts himself into staying in Cleveland with all these teams where he's the best guy by far and Mo Williams is his best teammate. Like, I think he's going to regret it. I really do.
I think he will, too. And I thought it was interesting. You know, LeBron has given all sorts of mixed signals out there. But his last little line about, I'm loyal to Akron, was probably one of the more interesting things that I've heard him say. It's not like he's, I understand, you know, people look at it, well, he's from the same state. But it's not like he's from Cleveland. He's from Akron. And it's enough where I thought LeBron was making the distinction that, you know, I'll always be loyal to my homeboys. But, right. You know, I think, you know, Cavs fans are going to hate us for this. But I think all of us want to see LeBron competing for multiple titles. We want to see him in the finals. He's amazing to watch. And if he re-signs with Cleveland, I have my doubts about whether that's going to happen.
Yeah, I never want to see him in a situation again where he's taking on a really good team that's playing well, like Orlando last summer. He's basically taking them on 1-on-5, because that is not the amount of work that he put in to that entire playoffs. I just don't think it's fair. I don't think that guy could have done anything else, and his team still wasn't good enough, you know, and that was against the Magic, who got wiped out in the finals. So one last thing, because I know you have to go. KG's knee, have you heard anything?
Haven't. You know, obviously that's the big question in Boston right now.
Nobody's asking.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's a question nobody's asking. I haven't heard. I think we're all assuming he's going to be fine.
Why are we assuming this? This guy's been in the league 14 years. He just had a surgery that they had to staple things back to his knee bone and then hope the staples held. And I don't think this is a sure thing at all. And I have talked to as many people as I possibly can. Nobody has seen him play basketball.
Yeah.
Well, I'm concerned.
This may be the underreported story. I mean, maybe I've been sleeping on this a little bit, Bill.
Chad, you're sleeping. Wake up.
I'm assuming, given the Celtics and what they did this summer, that you know, KG is going to be there. Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I should have read different into the Rasheed Wallace signing.
And Big Baby. By the way, the Celtics spent like $12 million this summer. Most of it was a power forward. We already have a guy making $20 million. And I don't know. I don't know what to believe. I want to meet one person who's seen Kevin Garnett run this season in 2009. I have not met that person yet.
Well, you know, that, and I'm still interested to see how Rondo takes the, you know, that's a story that's faded. All the beating he took before the draft will be interesting on a young player to see how he responds to all that on the court. That's the other thing I watch close, because he took about as bad a beating for a guy who's played about as well as you could possibly play at his age. The beating he took this summer from his own organization was just, I couldn't believe it.
I'll tell you who it didn't fade for. Rajon Rondo. You think he's fine with it right now? You think he's like, oh, great, I get to play with the Celtics again. I guarantee he's ticked off. And I'll tell you another thing. I don't think Perkins is that happy either. That now he has to worry about whether he's going to play crunch time or whether Rasheed Wallace is going to play crunch time. I have a lot of concerns. But on the good side, you know, there's really Orlando got worse. I feel like Cleveland is either treading water or got worse, and nobody really stepped up. So, you know, maybe war of attrition, they'll still be the best team.
Oh, there's hope. I mean, there's hope. You know that you get all Celtics healthy in the playoffs, and they can beat anybody.
I'm hoping. Got the fingers crossed.
It's a big if. It's a big if, brother.
Chad, chase down that KG story for me, because I can't sleep at night.
All right.
Do it for me. Chad Ford, ESPN.com. We will read you all summer, and enjoy the beautiful weather of Hawaii.
All right. Talk to you later, Bill.
All right. Thank you.
Bill, Jacko, partners in crime. The Subway, fresh take on life.
Hello.
Oh, Johnny, with the hello.
Hey there. What's going on?
Very quick 10-minute phone call for you. It's Friday, Labor Day weekend. We just talked to Chad Ford. Realized I hadn't talked to you in a while, which was not by design. You've been away. You've been on vacation. You've been doing stuff.
I bought a house, been taking down wallpaper, doing household chores, that type of thing. Yeah, very busy.
The house that Jacko built.
Yes, it is. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
How are you, quickly, how are you feeling about the juggernaut that is the New York Yankees?
Great. I feel great. I mean, they're on fire. I read in the paper today that they have only become the second team in history to have five separate seven-game winning streaks. in a season. I believe it was five. Hmm. And the other team was the 1998 juggernaut Yanks that won 116 games or 100 and what was it? They ended up being 125 and 50 when you factor in the playoffs. So
and that team cheated too.
Come on now, Big Poppy. Don't tell me that.
Hey, listen, Derek Jeter, it's certainly realistic that he's going for the Triple Crown right now.
Oh, my God.
Age 35.
Please.
I think it's great.
Oh, my God.
Let's not have him pee in a cup.
Oh, my God. Come on.
Hey, listen. Hey,
oh, what an this is I'm hanging up right now. That's outrageous.
Hey, he's Rogers Hornsby all of a sudden, age 35. There's no red flags.
You can say what you want about me and other Yankees, but don't you dare blaspheme against Derek Jeter. Blasphemy. Sinner.
Listen, it's perfectly reasonable for somebody to have a career year at age 35.
It's
it
not
happens
like
all the time.
He's not having a big number. He's not having a big year with home runs. If it was, you know, Brady Anderson and suddenly he was jacking up 50, yeah, okay, red flags would be raised. But it's just a consistent player. He's having a big year. Worked on his game. It's all coming together.
Johnny,
good lineup.
Just let me have my moment of peeing on something.
Try it, yeah.
I'm out of ammo. I got nothing.
What are you bummed out about? Your team is a juggernaut, too. We both know it's... I mean, the thing is, I can't even take another ALCS, and I know it's heading in that direction. We're going to be, like, up for seven-hour games. I'll be going to bed at 2 o'clock in the morning every night. I know it's coming in late October or mid-October. I know it's coming. There's no question.
I actually think this is going to be the year that the... that the Angels finally break through against the Red Sox. The Kazmir trade bummed me out. Just to be able to get Kazmir, and then he looked awesome in his last start. That's somebody that, if he's on, can give the Red Sox some trouble, especially our lefties. And
I know he pitches well against the Sox and the Yankees.
Yeah, it's not good. It's that was not a trade I was happy about. And, you know, it's not like Tampa Bay got this motherload of prospects for him. It was clearly a salary dump. So why do it now? Why are you trying to swing the race?
That's what I understand.
Jerks.
Tampa Bay was still theoretically in the wild card. I mean, they're done now. The Sox took 2 out of 3. But last week, they were still theoretically in the wild card. Like, I don't understand why you would just wave the white towel at that point. I mean, I just don't get it. Throw in the towel, wave the white flag. I don't get it.
How about this part? How about the part where you could just make that trade same trade this winter?
Yeah.
It's not like that trade, but the trade of 40 cents on the dollar or whatever you get for Scott Kazmir. That's going to be there in December, Tampa Bay.
And it's not even like a salary thing, because there's only like 2 months in the season left. A month left in the season, so it's
terrible.
Not like you're prorated. You're not saving yourself a fortune.
I was just getting mad this whole series. Like, of course, Watfo, Tampa, back to the hole. Oh yeah, we don't care about our baseball team anymore. That lasted. I tweeted it lasted about as long as a fat guy using a treadmill. Tampa's love for baseball.
Yeah, 15 people in the stands the other day?
No, well, there was a crowd, but it was all Boston fans.
Oh, yeah,
The Tampa fans, they've moved on to a new bandwagon. Thanks for the 9 months, though, fellas.
Right, exactly.
And now they've swung the race by giving
the Angels,
giving them this lefty starter who is going to do well against Boston's lineup if he's healthy. It's not fair. It makes me mad.
I can understand that. I'll believe the Angels beat you when I see it. Until then, I'm not a believer.
How did you enjoy the fact that the Red Sox have this will become famous this season for stacking the 2009 National League pennant race?
with A-plus
starters.
We've had this discussion obviously in other podcasts about how weak the National League is, but I mean if it was a trial before a judge, we would just rest our case with John Smoltz and Brad Penny's performances.
Oh my God.
Is there any question? Is there any debate? It's the most open and shut thing in the history of mankind.
I loved reading the Brad Penny stories after where they're making up these convoluted reasons why it was so good. Oh, his fastball is humming tonight. It's like, his fastball was always humming. It's just he was in a league where people know how to hit 96 mile an hour fastballs.
Exactly.
When the guy has no second pitch. It's like, oh, his breaking ball was great. No, his breaking ball stinks. It's never great.
He stinks. It's a ridiculous league, and they just accept it and deal with it.
It's awful.
I mean, Smoltz is 2-1 with an ERA in around the 3 range, I believe. And Penny pitched, eight scoreless innings or something?
There's always a conspiracy there. Yeah, with Smoltz, they said, oh, yeah, he's tipping pitches in Boston.
Yeah.
Oh, really? He was tipping his 84-mile-an-hour fastball? The hitters needed to know it was coming. Give me a break.
Oh, it is a joke.
What was Lugo's excuse for hitting for the Triple Crown the first 2 weeks?
I know, Lugo
there.
And Matt Holliday. I mean,
yeah, Matt Holliday.
Case closed. We rest.
It's
ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous.
And you know what bothers me is they'll probably end up winning the World Series, which will give more credence to the fact that this is a real league.
Exactly. Yeah, you'll get 100 emails from people saying, "Sure, children, National League."
Yeah, what people don't realize is that Major League Baseball has basically turned into March Madness now.
Right.
With this extra long playoff system, and anybody can get hot for 10 days or 11 days or whatever. Look at the Red Sox in 2004. We're down 3-0 in a series. Mm. We were down one run. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you know all this stuff, Johnny?
I am familiar with that. Yes, I do recall it.
We were down one run in the ninth inning, somehow won that game, and then all we did was win 7 games in a row. We won the World Series. We won the championship. We just got hot for – basically, we got hot for 9 days.
That's it. It's like having a hot goalie in the, you know, the Olympics or in the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to make me – hey, the only thing that would be kind of cool is if the Dodgers made the World Series, and I'm turning on Manny, Johnny.
You are?
Yeah, I'm turning on him.
This is sad. I hate when long-term couples break up.
Well, you know what it is?
It's not even long distance. You live in the same town.
It's watching post-HGH, post-fertility drug Manny.
Yeah, he's not having a great year, is he?
Suddenly not looking like Manny anymore, which makes me think my whole relationship with Manny was a lie.
It was based on a lie.
My buddy Hersheimer, the Dodgers fan, I was complaining to him about how post HGH Manny, I just hope he gets hurt and never plays again, so I don't have to watch this anymore. And he's like, "Oh no, he's hurt. He got hit in the hand by a pitch. He'll be back." Mm-hmm. It's like, all right, I'm sure that was it.
You keep telling yourself that.
Yeah, it was the old pitch in the hand that did it. That's why he can't hit it out of the warning track.
Right. Right.
Ridiculous. I will say the one kind of feel good. Steroids HDH story has been A-Rod.
Yeah, he's having a quietly big year. I was listening to the radio yesterday, and I was thinking about this too. That I mean, he's gonna have 30 home runs and 100 RBIs after he missed like a month of the season. He missed like 28-30 games. Not to mention ever since the All-Star break, they've rested him one other game a week.
Yeah.
So to put up 30 and 100 in 2/3 of a season, it's not awful.
The other thing that's interesting, and I think Buster Olney was the one who wrote about this, and I wish I'd thought about it. Might not have been him, but I think it was about, this is kind of the other, that A-Rod kind of accepted who he was.
Yeah.
He's not really a sharp guy. He's not a funny guy. He's not a mega celebrity. He's not somebody that is like David Beckham, where he's going to, you know, go across all these different places to be marketed in different genres, and he's just a guy who can hit baseball and he's handsome. And that's really it. He's embraced it. He's got a celebrity girlfriend and he just hits baseballs and that's it.
Do you think that maybe Kate Hudson is like the anti Jessica Simpson?
I'll tell you something. I heard a story from a very reliable source that Kate Hudson is now saying no to all movies until November because A-Rod is convinced that Kate Hudson is his good luck charm, and she travels everywhere with him. That's the story I heard. Very reliable source.
She's Kim Basinger in The Natural, huh?
Kate Hudson's like, yeah, I'm going to turn down all movie
Basinger,
offers until November. And
she's Glenn Close. That was an egregious error on my part.
Yeah, it was egregious.
Kim Basinger was the jinx. What am I thinking about? It's this house. I must have been inhaling too many wallpaper fumes or something. So
Tara Reid was Kim Basinger. Kate Hudson's like, I'm not going to do a movie until November. And Hollywood's like, that's fine, Kate. Take your time. We'll have a crappy chick flick script for you ready in November. Don't worry. Keep your streak going.
Exactly.
What about something where your husband's dead? He comes back as a ghost.
She's got to wave the pom-poms in the playoffs into the World Series.
My wife and I watched the American Teen documentary last night.
American Teen?
Yeah. Very, very well done documentary about high school kids in Indiana.
Oh, really?
One of those you finish and you're like, did I make a mistake having kids?
Really? That
yeah,
kid,
it's
huh?
one of those. Hey, but very subtle. It's not like overtly depressing. It's just by the time it's over, you're like, wow. Kids are screwed.
It's got to be. Yeah, there's a lot going on for teenagers these days, I suppose. It was simpler when we were young.
It really was. You know, I always worried about having the birds and the bees talk with my daughter.
Yeah.
But now I also have the, here's why it's a bad idea to take naked cell phone pictures of yourself and mail them to a guy who claims that he won't forward them on anyone else. I have to have that conversation too.
Oh, my God. My God. It's troubling.
Let's just say that there's a girl in the film who gets the nickname Pepperoni Nipples.
10 people come up with the good authority for that nickname, I take it.
Yeah, there might have been a cell phone photo involved.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Yeah. I kind of wish we had had that nickname in college.
It's a good one.
Somebody, anybody.
Anyone would have worked. That was good. That's a good one.
Johnny, what do you have to say for the kids of America who return to college this week?
Wow, you threw by me there. That one caught me off guard.
Well,
I remember going to college, and I remember going out. Remember, we were like freshmen in our hall, and somebody, an upperclassman, when upperclassmen returned, or maybe it was like, it wasn't an RA, but I think there was some upperclassmen there that helped you move in, and somebody came by, and they were like, "Hey, wants to go to a keg party?" And I was like, "I do." And we went, like, I think we went down to Caro Street, the notorious Holy Cross place, that I would get to know much better over the course of 4 years.
Yes.
And I think I went out like the first night. It was good. You get to meet people, get in the social scene. It's the way to
go. Yeah,
don't be cloistered in your room. You got to get to like meet your new, you know, hallmates and such. Go out and have fun. Get to know each other.
My advice would be to go out and meet as many people as you can, as quickly as you can. Don't go overboard. Don't get completely obliterated every night.
But
be a social person.
Absolutely. Go make friends. These are people that you're going to get very close to very fast because you're living with them 24/7. And, you know, go start sharing the experiences and living the college life. It's great times.
Can you tell the story about when you called your soon-to-be freshman year roommate, Nick Aida, and how that conversation went? It's one of my all-time favorites.
I will. And then I'd like to share a story about being with Nick Aida 2 weeks ago in Northampton, Mass. But he's sort of peripheral to the story. But when you go off to college, as everyone who's listening to this probably knows, you get a letter in the mail, and it declares who your roommate is going to be. And so it's just a name and a town. And so my roommate was Nick Aida from Sandwich, Massachusetts. And I assumed that Nick Aida was Japanese, given his name, but he's actually not. But his name sounds like it's Japanese, Nick Aida. But he's not. So I called him up out of the blue, and it's kind of an awkward construct to begin with because you're calling someone that you're now going to live with who you've never met before.
Yeah, it's like calling somebody for a date, but worse.
Right.
Because if it goes badly, you can't just get out of the date. Yeah, you're stuck with the date.
So I called him up, and he was like, "Oh, it's kind of chaotic here. My sister's entertaining some guests or something." It was like, I didn't know what was going on. It seemed so formal. So we were talking about, one of the things you're supposed to do is, you go out and you get like this is how long ago it was. There was like no iPods, and, you had like a corded phone. There was no cordless phones, and, nobody had computers, or people rarely had computers. You had like a word processor. So I kind of had like a stream of consciousness and was rattling on all these things I had. So I'm like, oh, I have like a little refrigerator for the room, and I have a telephone and whatever else. So Aida was searching for something to say, and he wanted to say that he had something. And so he was like, I've got some hangers for the room. Wire hangers. So I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, what does this guy think? Like, my clothes are like on the floor? Like, I don't have any means of hanging my clothes in a closet? So it's so funny. So, we got to college and eventually told the story, and we busted his chops for 4 years about I've got hangers.
Well, tell the story about when you showed up the first day.
We showed up the first day to Holy Cross, and, Holy Cross is kind of, at the time, was very preppy, and everybody sort of fits a cookie cutter mold, and
Irish Catholic
and preppy, and from the Northeast generally. And so I get up to Holy Cross, and first of all, I'm looking for the Japanese guy that I think is going to be my roommate. And Nick Aida is not Japanese, he's Italian. But we're loading the car, my parents' car, with stuff, and we see this guy in a long-sleeve tie-dyed T-shirt and these, like, I don't know, he had some kind of pants or long shorts that extended beyond his knees and, like, Chuck Taylor Converse sneakers.
And he's got an earring.
He's got an earring, and he's got this, like, mullet and these John Lennon, grandfather glasses. And I kind of looked on, and I was like, oh, my God. And my mother goes, watch that be your roommate. And then he turned around, and he had a box, and it said Aida on it. Oddly, it did not contain hangers.
That's a great one. And then you move in with him. This is great. See, this is I miss this about college, like just how random life is. You move in with him, and then almost immediately his girl that he likes in high school breaks up with him, and he goes into this Morrissey Cure swoon.
Right.
Smiths and just nonstop depressing music. And
well, the funny thing is he came up to college, and again, this is how long ago it was. he had like a box of cassette tapes. There was no, it was the early days of CDs, and there was certainly no iPods. And he had all these cassette tapes, and it was all like The Cure and The Smiths. And I remember you and I, we got to be friendly, and we would go in and we would pull out his tapes and we would like make fun of all the songs names because The Smiths were just so morbidly depressing. And it'd be like, yeah. I hope you have an unhappy birthday. And, you know, everything's, oh, heaven knows I'm miserable now. And all these things, and we were like, ha ha ha, laughing about it. Within like a year, that's all we listened to was like The Smiths and The Cure.
Right. So
he was kind of a trailblazer in that
way. He really was. He wore us down.
Exactly. So we all got to be friends with Nick Aida, and he was a good guy, so he continues to be so.
Yes, he became one of our group.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so ironically, 2 weeks ago, I got together with he and two other guys from college, the Blue Boy and Horgan, up in Northampton, Massachusetts for a little boys' weekend. So Friday night, we went out in Northampton for Ned on the Town, and the Yankees were playing the Red Sox that weekend. So that was the night of the 20-11, I think, was the final Yankees-Red Sox debacle, where Brad Penny's last start as a Red Sox. So we go out in the town in Northampton, and, you know, I'm in the heart of Red Sox Nation, so I was really calm and quiet. We were having dinner, watching the game, and just joking around with these guys. And all three of the guys I was with are Red Sox fans, so I'm not going to be obnoxious to begin with. I mean, there's times I would be, but not at this time. So we end up in some bar that's kind of like sports bar-y, which is kind of odd for Northampton. But we're in this bar, and they have big-screen TVs, so we're sitting at the bar. And we're just watching the game, and it's like, you know, it's a horrific game. It's 20-11. Neither bullpen can get anybody out. So the Yankees were, you know, piling on the score, and I would kind of like applaud quietly. And the whole bar is like, everyone in the bar is rooting for the Red Sox and heckling, you know, the Yankees. So I'm keeping this extremely low profile. And something happened in the ninth inning where, like, Sergio Mitre hit Rocco Baldelli or something.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's a guy across the bar from me. He's like, you know, he's probably like, maybe he's like 50 years old. He's got like white hair and a goatee. He's with his wife. Seems like a calm, regular Joe. And all of a sudden he starts pointing at me. And he's pointing at me and like gesturing at me. And I'm like looking behind me like, what's up with that guy? And all our buddies are like, what's up with that guy? What's going on? So the Yankees win the game. And I just clap my hands like twice, did like the Jeter fist pump. I don't obviously scream anything out or say anything. And all of a sudden the guy like gives me the finger. And he gets up and his wife's trying to push him out and he keeps giving me the finger. And then he's like pointing at me and pointing at the door like he wants me to go outside and fight him.
No!
Oh, yeah. Like, I'm like, what? And everyone's like, what? Why is that guy giving you the finger? You know, Aida and Horgan and the Blue Boy. They're like, why is that guy giving me the finger? I'm like, I guess because I was rooting for the Yankees. So I'm like, Red Sox Nation, everybody. Like, I just couldn't have been any calmer. And the guy was like, is with his wife and he's going to like fight me in the streets of Northampton for daring to have the temerity to root for the Yankees.
That's great. How does somebody even motion somebody to go outside? You point to the person?
Yeah, he would point at me, and then he was like point, like he was on the opposite side of the bar, and his wife's kind of ushering him out, and he's pointing at me, and then he's like pointing at the door, and he's like saying with his, I think he was saying, you know, he's screaming expletives at me, and I got the sense like he wanted me to go outside.
That's great.
So obviously, I did not. My younger days, I, you know, would have had a few with me, and I might have been, you know.
I'm going to say about seven Guinnesses, you might have accepted that invitation.
Yeah, but I'm old and calm now, so.
I'm going to say that wasn't the last time or the first time that guy has probably done that.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, you know, it was so funny. So.
Last thing we have to talk about, Curt Schilling.
Yeah, Senator.
stepping into the shoes of longtime Senator Ted Kennedy.
Yeah.
Possibly. This is like so many different elements.
Oh.
You're like, you hate Curt Schilling, you
right.
hate Massachusetts.
Right.
But yet he would run as a Republican.
Exactly. I was very torn. Exactly right. I don't know. I don't really support anything that gives Curt Schilling more of a platform to hear himself talk. That's what I've come down on. I think that my hatred of Curt Schilling is so deep and so profound that it trumps his being a Republican.
Really? So you'd,
yeah.
you'd almost root against him?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Just because he's such a blowhard and so full of himself that I just could not see him. That would be a bridge too far. It's just too much. I just couldn't take it. No pun intended, by the way, on that. On the Ted Kennedy seat, a bridge too far. That was inadvertent. yeah, Curt Schilling.
Let him chill.
Thank you. I'll be here all week. Maybe I did deserve to be beaten up in Northampton. But no, that one is, I cannot support Curt Schilling's candidacy. I'm afraid not.
I mean, I could see it happening in Minnesota, like with Jesse Ventura or something, but in Massachusetts?
The interesting thing would be how Red Sox fans would perceive it, because Massachusetts is about 95% Democrat, but it's also 99.9% Red Sox fan. And Curt Schilling brought them their first World Series in 86 years.
Yeah.
The bloody sock and everything else. I mean, if you're like a typical Red Sox-ite, mass person, you'd be really torn there, because your heart would always go with the Democrats, or you're always going to go with the Democrats, but your heart would kind of go with Schilling. So that would have been interesting to me. But now I guess he says like the chances are slim to none.
I really like Schilling, and I'm on his side, but I also understand why everybody else doesn't like him.
Oh, sure.
I think it would be. I just don't. I can't support like him running for Senate.
The fascinating thing would be if Joe Kennedy, Ted Kennedy's nephew, ran for the seat, as is rumored, I guess. Oh. And you had a Kennedy against Curt Schilling. I mean, literally heads would explode in Massachusetts. Heads would explode.
You know, it's funny, though. In 2003, if you had said, we're going to win the World Series, but it's going to happen because of a heroic performance by a pitcher who, in a couple years, is going to become a blowhard Republican senator.
Right.
That replaces Ted Kennedy. I think all of us would have been like, okay, sounds good. Sign me up. I'll take it.
Yeah, you would have taken it under any circumstances there. Absolutely. Yeah.
We would have done anything.
All right.
Anything. All right, Johnny. So where are you this week?
Oh, like a one.
Minus? Are you in the minus range?
Yeah, I feel good. Their winning game started by Sergio Mitre and Chad Gaudin. Like a week ago, they almost combined on a one-hitter. Or they did combine on a one-hitter. When that's happening, you're playing with some house money. So.
Is there a team you're afraid to play?
Oh, the Red Sox, sure. Okay. Right. Yeah, I'm not going to lie to you. If they're going to play in the ALCS, and the Yanks will be up 3-0, and my inbox is going to be inundated with emails like, got you right where we want you. And it won't even be funny, because it'll be true.
All right, Johnny, worst of luck.
And, you too.
Thanks for being in the Subway Fresh Tech Hotline. Talk to you soon.
Anytime. Later.
Bye-bye.
Target the center.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.